From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall at cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 301 of Sunday House Call. We're broadcasting live from the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA here in Ottawa on an absolutely beautiful, sunny Sunday. And we're taking your calls at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 at Bell Mobility, and 1-800-580-2372. And I have a few different stories to bring to you first. And also, I encourage you to call earlier rather than later. Once again, because we can get you on sooner. And as well, at the end of the show, there tends to be people who are left hanging and they've been waiting for about 20 minutes. And so I want to try to get you in as quickly as possible. We're actually going to go to the calls right now, just because they're starting to fill up. And I'm going to speak to, good afternoon, to Janice. Janice, are you there?
Dr. Dworkin.
Yes.
I'm on the speakerphone. Is that okay?
If you can, there's a bit of an echo with the speakerphone, but if that's all there is, that's okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Whoop. I guess Janice has she'll probably be calling back because she was on the speakerphone. We're going to go to line two and speak to Al. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, doctor. I'm calling about parasites.
Yes.
Apparently, like, the body has, like, you know, who knows how many parasites. Everybody seems to, most people seem to have them, but I guess our immune system combats them quite well. But there are some, like, on the internet, there's some prescriptions of how to get rid of parasites in your body, like, you've heard of green cloves and wormwood and black walnut. Do you think that all this is worth it, or that don't worry about parasites?
Well, the first thing is that parasites in and of themselves, a parasite by definition is an organism that sort of goes along for the ride and uses the resources of your body to survive and reproduce. So, for example, and they can cause disease. So you're looking at tapeworms or other worm infestations. That's a parasite from water supply, what we call a Giardia or Entamoeba histolytica. Those are also parasites. They're intestinal parasites. But they usually will produce symptoms of disease in people who have this. We have to differentiate between those organisms, which are indeed parasites, and the normal bacteria that live in our gut, which are not parasitic in nature. They're symbiotic. They live in concert with what our gut does. They protect our gut. So you don't want to knock out those particular bacteria. So the advertisements out to destroy parasites in our bodies, for a normal healthy person, there is no need to do anything to change what is going on in our intestines. So to buy a product to get rid of a parasite, unless there is specific tests that is done to check for parasites and eggs and such in our stool, which is normally where you do testing for parasites. If those are negative, and for most people, indeed, they are negative, there's no need to use any of these products.
Okay. In other words, there is a danger of getting rid of the good bacteria.
Well, yeah. I mean, for the same reason that you don't want to use an antibiotic indiscriminately, because it will destroy the normal, what we call gastric or colonic flora, which implies the bacteria that are there. You don't want to upset the balance unless there is the benefit of doing that, in other words, getting rid of a bacterium or bacteria that is dangerous or causing harm. For example, somebody who has pneumonia, you're going to treat the pneumonia to get rid of the bacteria that's causing it, but you may end up with temporarily altering the bacterial counts that are in the intestine. But obviously, defeating the pneumonia is an important thing to do. But I think what you're facing with these ads are creating a sense of something that is there that is not, in order for them to sell the particular product.
Yeah. So if it's not broke, don't fix it.
You got it, Al.
Okay, thanks.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. And we are going to go back to Janice. Good afternoon, Janice.
Yes, afternoon. I'm calling because I had a lung infection, actually, as far as I know, from about last September.
Mm-hmm.
I had been seeing a respirologist, and initially she wasn't too concerned. But when we had a CAT scan, it showed infection on my lung. Now, I've had a course of prednisone, 25 milligrams for mm-hmm. about 6 weeks. After that, the breathing test showed some improvement, but lately when I had another CAT scan in March, there's still infection.
Well, it sounds like inflammation and not infection.
Inflammation.
Right,
because
if they're using prednisone, that's to reduce the inflammation. So you're looking at
inflammation, yes.
Right, so they haven't been able to diagnose yet what the cause of the inflammation is from what you're mentioning.
No. When I've asked her, she said it's like it's a non-specific thing. She really can't mm-hmm. diagnose it. But I guess I'm concerned that was a fairly long treatment of a powerful medication in some ways.
Yeah.
I'm diabetic, and I have, that's under control and all, but I'm concerned because now I'm still back on the prednisone
mm-hmm.
With the addition of an antibiotic.
Right.
Now, I guess I'm wondering whether I should be concerned, whether you would have any suggestions about what some of the causes might be or what
well,
some
you
other...
Usually with inflammation of the lung, the inflammation is usually the end result of something. So when you look at various diseases that can affect the lung, you've got standard ones such as asthma or allergic-mediated diseases that can cause inflammation in the lung.
Mm-hmm.
You also have autoimmune diseases or diseases that can cause arthritic conditions can also cause problems with the lung for some conditions that can also do that. But in terms of making a diagnosis, sometimes what the respirologists may want to do if treatments have not worked very well, and that usually happens when there's no specific diagnosis because you can only treat what you have a diagnosis for, is sometimes to do what's known as a bronchoscopy or a biopsy of the tissue that is actually inflamed in order to try to make a diagnosis of what is happening. So that may be something that follows, but it's very difficult for me, Janice, to diagnose that because the inflammation in and of itself is only a description of what's happening to the tissue and it's not a diagnosis.
Right.
So really the next steps, if they've done blood work and they've tried mm-hmm. to from that blood work to see if there's any antibodies that would be reflective of an autoimmune disease or arthritic condition or a rheumatologic condition,
mm-hmm.
if that's been done and that hasn't really shown anything, then you may want to speak to the respirologist about more invasive reviews of trying to diagnose it. That is, ask if a biopsy is indicated for this situation.
Okay, that's helpful. Now, because my understanding is that a condition like this can leave scar tissue, and it has been going on for quite a long time now.
Chronic inflammation can cause the lung to become stiffer in terms of its ability to expand, depending on the condition itself, which is why you're taking the prednisone to try to inhibit that or block that from happening. So
I see.
And ideally, for treating with prednisone, if it's going to be used, you use the smallest amount for the maximum benefit, which is what I think your respirologist is trying to do to try and find the right right dosing for you. But ultimately, yes, you're right. It's not the main solution to the problem because you don't have the diagnosis yet.
Right. Okay, well, that's very helpful. We'll see what we can do from here on.
All right. Well, thanks for calling, Janice.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Bye.
And we're going to take a short break. We have Jerry, who wants to talk about knee replacement and medications, and Ava has a question about low blood platelet counts. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, 1-800-580-2372, outside our listening area, 521-TALK, 521-8255 is the number to call. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin is brought to you in part by Motion Specialties for all your home health care needs.
580 CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, Sunday House Call at CFRA.com. Now back to Dr. Barry Dworkin on 580 CFRA Sunday House Call. The numbers 521-TALK, 521-8255.
And just before we get to the calls, I wanted to bring to your attention how essentially food producers, I know I tend to harp on this, but it's beyond the pale sometimes on how they jump on bandwagons presenting how they are the bastions of protecting and giving you information to make sure you make smart health choices. But in effect, they try to dupe you. In this case, this is one, again, it's from one of my favorite websites or web blogs, Dr. Yoni Friedhoff's web blog called Weighty Matters. And in this, it was the Coca-Cola is advertising now upfront calorie labeling. And in fact, this advertisement was in one of our local newspapers. And in fact, it says upfront calorie labeling. No need to read between the lines. At Coca-Cola, we're starting to add calorie information to the front of our packages. The easier it is to find the calories, the easier it is to make the choices that help you and your family achieve a sensible, balanced diet. It's just another thing we're doing to help make the world we live in a little bit better. To learn more about what we're doing and why we're doing this, join us at livepositively.ca. And there's a bottle of Coca-Cola, which is 591 milliliters, sort of almost like a standard plastic bottle now that people tend to buy. And on the label, it says 110 calories. Now, that would be nice if indeed it was 110 calories. Problem is that it's not 110 calories for 591 milliliters. When you look closer, it is 110 calories for 250 milliliters of Coca-Cola. So when you do the math, you actually are looking at 260 calories in the bottle, even though in nice big red letters on a white background, it says 110 calories, and then they give you the little qualifier at the bottom in small font. So when you pick up a bottle, and you can bet a lot of people will be picking up the bottle and assuming it's 110 calories because it's just right there in front of you, wouldn't it be nice for them to just actually put 260 calories on the bottle as opposed to 110? Why do the 110 per 250 if you're trying to be honest with the public? Why standardize it like that? Because why don't you just put it for what the bottle actually is? Because most people will drink what's in the entire bottle. So I think it's a shameful practice, and it's just another way for companies to seem like they're jumping on a bandwagon to help you out to understand that, you know, sugar content and calories that are being taken in can be harmful, especially in greater quantities. But in this case, it's simply a marketing gimmick as opposed to being truthful with the public. We're going to go to line two and speak to Jerry. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Dr. Dworkin. How are you, sir?
I'm fine. How are you?
Oh, I'm okay. I am a regular listener of your program.
Thank you.
Some time ago, I heard that that you gone for a knee replacement.
Yes, I did.
That's one knee or both?
I had one knee done, my left knee. I had a partial knee replacement done, and I actually, unfortunately, had to have that knee operated on four times before I had the joint set the right way.
So how are you feeling now?
I'm feeling just great.
And also you said that you take Celebrex.
I use Celebrex sometimes. I don't particularly pitch for any particular product. I just use that because I tend to have stomach issues as well, and I find that using certain anti-inflammatories can irritate my stomach, so I tend to use Celebrex because it doesn't tend to hurt my stomach as much.
What strength is...
What strength? Celebrex comes in 200 milligram strengths, so
yeah,
100 and 200.
That's what my doctor has recommended.
Right, right.
I don't have pain in the knee,
mm-hmm.
But I have a stiffness at the ankle and about 8-9 inches above.
Mm-hmm.
That stiffness, so my doctor sent me for Doppler and what's the other test? Ultrasound.
Mm-hmm.
And they found out that I have WAIN, which is reflux or incompetent.
Yes.
On both sides of hip.
So, you said it was venous. You're saying the problems with the veins.
Yeah.
So venous insufficiency.
Right.
Yes.
So went to vein specialist and gone for a treatment, but the trouble didn't go away.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think it is? I think it might be with the nerves rather than vein.
Well, normally, when they what did the specialist do for the veins?
What do you mean?
Well, you said you went for to see someone for the veins to get that treated.
They treated with ultrasound guided injections.
Right. So they blocked up the veins so that they wouldn't swell up.
Right.
Okay. And so the problem that you're having now, though, is it pain or is it numbness or?
It's a stiffness.
A stiffness.
Right. And the vein specialist said that my treatment is complete.
Mm-hmm.
But the trouble didn't go away.
Now, is it stiffness in the ankle? It's hard to move the ankle?
No. It's the stiffness at the ankle and 8-9 inches above. When I walk quite a bit,
uh-huh.
it gets so stiff that I feel like falling down or sit down before I go any further.
Well, that doesn't sound like a nerve, though.
Oh.
A nerve wouldn't do that, especially... You know, usually when nerves get damaged, you get more numbness or tingling. And especially in that area where it's on the ankle and on the leg, you would expect it to happen in the foot first if there was nerve damage just because of the way the nerves flow.
Mm-hmm.
You can still have connective tissue and muscle in the area that is getting pulled or is tight, which especially if it's when you're walking, you notice that this happens to get worse while you're walking.
Right. And some days when I exert myself too much, then it gets so stiff that I feel like doing nothing, just sit down.
Right.
And then I explained to my doctor, and my doctor prescribed Celebrex at 200 milligrams.
Well, that'll help if there's any pain. I don't know if it's going to help for stiffness or if things are tightened up.
It does help, doctor. Yeah. If I take that, it's quite a relief. And then for... Okay. 2 or 3 days, I'm okay, and then it starts again.
Well, from what you're describing, it sounds like an inflammatory process because that's what any anti-inflammatory is going to do. It'll reduce swelling and pain in an area, and it may be from just using, when you're walking, you're pulling on structures that are getting swollen, and that's why that hurts. One of the other issues is to have your feet looked at with regards to proper support for your feet and the shoes that you're wearing. Because commonly what tends to happen is that we don't change our shoes very often in terms of getting new shoes, and we don't have shoes that support our feet very well.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if you're walking a certain distance, that can certainly cause pain as the foot tries to adapt to the way the shoe is. So if you have a shoe that doesn't support very well, your foot position is not going to be normal. And you'll end up putting stresses on structures in the ankle, in the lower leg, and in the feet that end up starting to hurt.
So should I go to a shoe specialist shop?
I would go to a place exactly that will look at your feet and give you a good evaluation of what is happening. Your doctor certainly can recommend a place. I can also, if you want to wait on hold, until the break in a few minutes, our technical producer can give you the name of a place to go. I just don't want to say this over the air and then have people calling and say, why didn't you mention this place or that place or the other on the air? So I'll give it to you privately off the air so that you can call them. I have a lot of confidence in their ability to at least make that assessment for you. But you should also speak to your physician about it.
Mm-hmm. I will do that, doctor.
Okay, so if you hang on, we'll be able to give you that name in a few minutes.
Sure.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And we're going to go. We have about a minute, but we will go past. We will continue this after the break. But I don't know if we're going to break a bit early or not. I think what we'll do is we're going to break a bit early so that way we don't interfere with answering the question in full. We actually have two lines available at 521-TALK, 521-8255, *588 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 from outside our calling area. Any questions that you have, and you can also send your emails to sundayhousecall@cfra.com, sundayhousecall@cfra.com. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call, and we'll be back after the news with your questions.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. Now back to Dr. Barry Dworkin on 580 CFRA Sunday House Call. The numbers 521-TALK, 521-8255.
And we're going to go to line three, and good afternoon to Ava.
Hello, Dr. Dworkin.
Hi.
My husband's platelets, he went to had his blood work done a little while ago, and they were low at 139. And it's supposed to be normal is 150 to 400?
But 150 to 400, but 139 is not really that low when you look at it. But
right. But what would be the cause of it to drop, and what could you do for it to bring it back?
Well, the first thing, though, is to first find out whether that result is actually accurate. So usually when you have a value from the lab of 139, usually you want to do another test just to see if the level bounces back up, because it can be lab error. It can also be from various medications somebody's taking. Is he taking any medications?
He's taking blood pressure and cholesterol. Cholesterol is only 10 milligrams, and his blood pressure is 10 milligrams.
Okay. So again, when trying to figure out whether a platelet count or a low platelet count, and for our listeners, platelets are important for the mechanism for clotting and blood clotting. Usually, for a platelet count to be very low and dangerous, you're looking at levels of around 20. So that sort of gives you an idea of how he's at 139.
Yes.
I'm
sorry. What I wanted to ask, he's taking aspirin, and he also takes quite a bit of Advil, like at night or something. He has trouble to sleep, he take Advil. Would that be any problem?
It shouldn't. It's not something that usually will decrease platelet production. So, I mean, there are certain things that you want to do if there is a true reduction of platelets. But for the most part, for platelet counts that are, 139, 140, there's not much that you do unless you start seeing the level continue to drop. And so one lab result doesn't mean anything. More lab results that come back showing a consistently low amount, then there's a specific approach that you take, right? There's usually a history that you have to look at, whether there was any recent viral infections, whether there was any previous disease that he had with regards to his blood system, whether there's any other conditions that he had, a positive family history of bleeding or low platelet counts, recent vaccinations with live viruses, what his nutritional status is, any alcohol intake that he's had. So those are some of the things that you would have to consider as well when taking an initial history with someone with low platelet counts. And then there's all kinds of blood tests that are done that follows, and there's quite a few that you will do in order to try to make a diagnosis of why that's happening. Why is production lower? Sometimes going all the way down to bone marrow assessment. But again, at a level of 139, the first step to take was probably to repeat the test just to see if that level truly was a low level or whether it was just a lab error for that day.
Right, and he's going to go in next month to have it done again.
Right, and that, so even though it's a bit low, it's not anything that endangers him. He still has quite a lot of platelets. He's not at risk of having any bleeding of that sort with a level of 139.
Okay, then. Well, thank you, doctor. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Ava.
Thank you. Bye.
Goodbye now. 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility. We have lots of lines available if you'd like to call in now. More than happy to speak with you, and you should be able to get on before the show comes to an end in about 18, 19 minutes from now. We're going to go to Hilda and on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi, it's Gilda.
Oh, Gilda, sorry.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
I wanted to talk about my thyroid. I'm kind of between a rock and a hard spot here between two specialists.
Okay.
I have an enlarged thyroid with a nodule, which has been biopsied as benign, and some cysts, and it's hard to the touch.
Okay.
And it's causing me problems, and my idea was to get it removed. On the one hand, the one specialist feels I also have acid, and he's feeling that this is a problem and hesitating to touch the thyroid, giving me something to deal with the acid.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get the relationship between, I understand that, you know, he's got a point about the acid, so we reduce the acid, but I don't see how that touches the thyroid.
Well, what symptoms are you having? That
difficulty swallowing, loss of hair, and pain.
Okay. Well, difficulty swallowing, the thyroid gland will not usually affect, an especially with a nodule, will not affect swallowing because the thyroid is sitting outside. It's sitting on the thyroid cartilage, which is that hard cartilage that you feel in the front of your throat.
Mm-hmm.
Your esophagus, which is the tube that allows food to swallow, is actually sitting behind the airway that is right there. That where you feel that thyroid cartilage is where you have the beginning of the airway or the tube, the bronchus that heads down into the lungs.
Mm-hmm.
And even behind that tube, you have your esophagus.
Mm-hmm.
So any nodule that's sitting on the outside of a hard cartilage area is not going to be big enough to put pressure on the tube, the esophagus, for you to be and have that problem swallowing.
Okay.
So there has to be another mechanism then that is leading to you having difficulty swallowing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where you have to think of gastroesophageal reflux, where acid can come up and damage the esophagus, can cause inflammation, can cause strictures, or even a narrowing of the esophagus because of scarring, and that can cause certainly a difficulty to swallow. And so that's what the reason for giving something to reduce acid production is, to try to give the esophagus, if indeed there's reflux, to give the esophagus a chance to heal and reduce that sensation of difficulty swallowing. Now, the pain that you're having, though, is that pain right where the nodule is?
Well, it's pain where the thyroid is. I really couldn't tell you anything more than that.
So that's a separate issue then. Now, the thing to keep in mind, though, is because there are surgery can be done, but there are several nerves that are responsible for speaking.
Yeah.
That run in that area.
Yeah, he mentioned that.
And it's called the laryngeal nerve, the superior laryngeal nerve and inferior laryngeal nerve. And so if those nerves are damaged in the surgery, you can lose, usually depends on the side, but there's nerves on either side, right and left, and they're responsible for how our vocal cords work. And so if one of those nerves is damaged, you may have a change in your voice because one of the vocal cords won't work as well. So that's also something to consider, especially since the nodule that has been found is found to be not cancerous. So now you would be doing surgery to remove something that, from a health perspective, not a pain perspective, but from a health perspective, is not doing you harm. But removing that may cause damage to the nerve and result in a permanent damage to your voice. So those are some of the issues in terms of determining risk and benefit that you really have to think about before doing the surgery to fix that. So I think that's why they're hesitant as well, is because there are complications, potential complications from the surgery, and the surgery would be simply to remove a nodule that is not causing health damage. It's maybe causing pain, but it's not causing damage in terms of risk of cancer or other thyroid problems.
But what would be wrong with removing the thyroid, which is my idea?
Well, if you remove the thyroid, are you taking any medication for the thyroid?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, well, removing the thyroid would even increase your risk more because you don't, because now you're looking at potentially damaging both the nerves on both sides and losing your voice completely.
I see.
So that's So Gilda, it's not a straightforward thing. It's not because they don't want to help you, but they're trying to assess the risk of doing something. It's not the thyroid gland is not a simple gland to remove.
No,
because of the nerves and other structures in the area.
See, I guess my concern too is that this thing may become what if it's precancerous and we let it sit? And
well, usually if they've done the biopsy, the biopsy will tell them what kind of tissue is there.
On
the basis of knowing what tissue is there, they will know whether that has a potential to become cancerous or not.
I see.
So if the biopsy showed no cancerous tumor and it showed tissue that is benign, it's unlikely for that to become cancerous afterwards.
Okay.
So I hope that's a bit helpful for you.
Well, it is, and thank you very kindly. I appreciate your help.
Oh, you're very welcome, Gilda.
Thanks.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
And all our lines are available at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility. And I've said it before, I can certainly talk to myself for a little while, but I'd rather be speaking with you. And we do have some emails that I might get into and answer some of your questions. There is also a relatively important news item, because a lot of people do call about this, and they're also afraid to bring this up with their physicians. And that has to do with overactive bladders. And there is a recent study that has come out and actually presented at the 25th Annual European Association of Urology Congress from the University Hospital Zurich in Switzerland. This is an 8-year follow-up of 240 patients who've had an overactive bladder. And these are people who have sudden and unstoppable need to urinate. So they really, when the bladder starts to contract, there's a muscle called the detrusor muscle. And when it starts to contract, it causes, you have to find the bathroom right away. You just can't wait. And in social situations, going out, going on vacations, pretty much anywhere that you go, people with this condition truly do suffer. And there are certain medications that are available that have been used to try and relax the muscles and exercises that can help strengthen them. But for many people, there really are very few long-term effective treatments. And so in this case, what the researchers did is they had 240 patients and they were given Botox that was injected into the muscle. And again, this was an 8-year study, but within 2 weeks of giving this particular treatment, and this was called, it was 100 units of botulinum A toxin, 84% of the patients experienced significant improvement of their bladder function 2 weeks afterwards. 75%, or 3 out of 4, reported that the urgency or the need to go to the bathroom right away stopped completely. And 85% reported that their incontinence was no longer a problem. They were able to function normally. So they also mentioned that using pads at night pad usage during the day dropped from an average of 5 pads a day to 0.5 pads a day. So 1/10 the use of pads, and the frequency in urination and nighttime urination decreased by 50%. And most participants were able to go longer between having to go to the bathroom. No further therapy was required for 30% of the patients, and only 16 patients reported poor benefit from the treatment. Sounds like, from this, looking at this study, not too bad. It, again, smaller study, 240 patients, but indeed looking over 8 years. Side effects included 20 urinary tract infections among the 240 patients and 7 temporary urinary retentions where they just weren't able to go to the bathroom. Nevertheless, I think this is an important study, something that gives people some hope. Whether it will be available here still remains to be seen. There's likely more studies to follow, but certainly an innovative use of using Botox, in this case, really helping these particular people in resuming normal lives. When we come back, we have Jean who wants to talk about the knee replacement question, and Robert has a question about the parathyroid glands. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call. Back with your calls in just a few minutes.
580 CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin is brought to you in part by Motion Specialties for all your home health care needs.
Now back to Dr. Barry Dworkin on 580 CFRA's Sunday House Call. The numbers, 521-TALK, 521-8255.
And over to line one, and good afternoon, Jean.
Yes, hello, Dr. Dworkin.
Hi.
I thought maybe you were going to touch on knee replacement with that previous call.
Okay.
It looks like I'm going to have surgery.
Okay.
And I just wondered, I know I have to work hard to get that knee working again.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wondered how incapacitated, for how long would you be incapacitated? I mean, for just managing things around the house. And I know you can't drive for 6 weeks and this sort of thing. But I just wondered what lies ahead.
Well, when are you scheduled for the...
Well, I'm seeing the surgeon on the 1st of June, and he's booking in the fall.
Okay.
So I wish it was in the summer, because
yeah.
I think it would be better to be getting back into circulation when
yeah.
the weather's good.
But. Well, you're right. It does depend on your overall state of health and endurance and leg strength prior to the surgery. So having a muscle, the quadricep muscle, that's as strong as possible is very helpful.
Okay.
Usually they get you up and going very quickly after the surgery. They
yes.
have you starting to, they want to get your knee moving, get you walking. the physiotherapists in the hospital will have you try to walk up and down the stairs once they're able to see you walk a little bit.
Right.
They have you in a walker or something where there's some support. So there is some initial rehab. Pain management is very important.
Right.
There are certain standard medications that are used to try to help alleviate the pain so you can move better.
Right.
But usually within the first week to 10 days, the goal is to try to get you up and walking,
right.
Sometimes with some help. But you are looking likely in terms of doing things around the house and being able to stand for a time. No, probably 3 to 4 weeks into that, you should be able to be doing some of that stuff.
I see.
But it does depend on you know, how your balance is now, how strong your legs are,
mm-hmm.
How much help you have at home as well.
Now, do you after you're in the hospital, I gather, for about 2 or 3 days, is it a good idea to go somewhere where you could get physiotherapy and care for a couple of weeks?
Usually they will help arrange that for you after the hospital discharge.
I see.
So it's not, they don't leave you to your own devices to try and find things. They will make recommendations and follow up.
All right.
It's sort of a standard procedure that they have.
Okay.
So there will be something available to you, and they may make referrals for you to see someone outside of the hospital.
Okay.
Other things that you'll have to be doing after your knee surgery as well is usually for 10 days after the surgery, so from the first day after, there's usually an injectable anticoagulant blood thinner that you use to prevent clots from occurring.
Okay.
And so there is that. So they may give you a prescription,
right,
for a medication to inject, or there is now an oral medication that is used, taken once a day. So instead of an injection, it's called Xarelto, which can be used. They're very expensive.
I see.
It works out to about $10 a pill for 10 days. So it's quite expensive.
Yes.
And then the injection is about the same cost. It usually runs up. Actually, after everything is said and done with dispensing fees and everything at the pharmacy, it's about $180 for the whole prescription.
For the whole thing.
But they will be giving you something for preventing clots for at least 10 days after the surgery, because that's where you're at most risk, because you're not walking around as much.
Right.
You tend to be sitting a lot, and so there's more chance of having blood clots afterwards.
Now, can you be alone in the house? I'm a senior, and I live alone.
I would say probably not. Not for the first few days, especially if they let you out of hospital.
Right.
3 or 4 days afterwards, you're still not going to be limber on your feet. You're going to need help.
Okay.
Transferring out of bed, going to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
It is not an easy thing to move around the house at the beginning.
No.
So if you have somebody who can come by or mm-hmm. if there's a place that you can stay at least for a week to 10 days, because what you're looking for is an ability. The main things you're looking for is your ability to go to the kitchen to prepare meals.
Right.
Go to the bathroom,
mm-hmm.
Take a bath or a shower,
mm-hmm.
Being able to get out of the bathtub. That's the kind of stuff, normal activities of daily mm-hmm. living that you have to be able to do. And if you can't do that after the surgery, then you do need somebody to help you out.
So would that be after the second week, the third week usually? Or
usually with strengthening and mobility and moving around, the goal is by the second to third week, or at least the third to fourth week, to be independent again.
Okay.
But it does vary. I mean, it's the type of thing that you will find out only once you're living through that. So the best thing is to think of it as a long-term scenario. So say by the fourth week, you want to be as independent as possible. So for those first 4 weeks, you may need to be in a living situation where there is some more help for you.
Okay.
I would be very concerned just you going home alone.
I have family that will visit, but I just wondered if I suppose somebody coming in daily would probably be the answer then.
That would be difficult, because what if you had to get up to go to the bathroom? you can't time it for someone coming over just for that time. So that's where you may need to have either, it may even be better to be at a family's place just for the first week as opposed to being at your place, just so that you have assistance, because there's no way to predict when you're going to need that assistance.
No, and it could be through the night, too. That's the other thing.
That's exactly it.
Well, thank you ever so much. That's been helpful. You've given me some things to think about now and plan for.
All right. You're very welcome, Jean.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Bye-bye now. And we're going to go to line three. And Linda, good afternoon. Linda, you got to turn your radio off. Linda, you have to turn your radio off.
Good afternoon, doctor. Good afternoon,
Linda, can you turn your radio off, please?
Okay, I'll do that.
Okay.
Okay, doctor, I have got high blood pressure.
Yes.
And I have been taking Diovan, which is 40 millimeter. Actually, I have the tablets 80.
Yes.
And I cut it half. And I want something natural relief than taking medicines. Taking medicines give me depression. And also, when I take bath, I feel like taking bath with cold water.
Mm-hmm.
And is that okay?
Well, first of all, Linda, there's no natural product that's going to reduce your blood pressure.
Why not?
Because there isn't.
Well, some people say that if you walk a lot.
Well, there's exercise, but that's not a natural product. There's exercising and eating well and lowering your salt.
That I do quite a lot.
But the problem is that blood pressure is a serious condition. Most people don't treat it well enough. And as a result, they end up with heart disease and kidney disease and strokes later on. So not taking a medication is not recommended if you have diagnosed high blood pressure. You can certainly do all the other things to help by reducing salt, by exercising, by eating lots of fruits and vegetables, but nevertheless, you still have to treat that.
I have to increase the dose of my...
I wouldn't say to increase the dose. That's up to your doctor to inform you about that. I can't give you recommendations over the phone for that.
I see.
Taking a bath in cold water depends how cold, because sometimes if you go into cold water, it can actually increase your blood pressure.
Really?
Yes. So that's something. Now, that would have to be very cold water. So it really depends on how what we're defining as cold.
Well, real cold. No.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't do that because that can cause constriction of the arteries and increase your blood pressure, especially if you step into a cold bath. So that's probably not a good thing to be doing.
And my feet burn quite a lot.
Well, unfortunately, Linda, we're out of time. So I can't answer your question, question now. So I'm going to, unfortunately, we have to end the show there. Thanks for your call. Remember, you can send emails to sundayhousecall@cfra.com. My thanks to all the callers and my apologies to Robert. And I can hopefully get to your question next week. All our listeners, thank you for listening. And we'll be back with edition number 302 next week on Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. Have a great week.